Welcome to the 11KBW podcast, a 2P update by James Gowdy QC. This talk was given at the 11KBW Employment Law Conference on the 16th of May 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
And let me start with a Euro-friendly remark. France has a top 14 rugby. I have a top 14 2P cases, if you wondered where the number came from. It also, of course, came from the fact that that is about the number of important or important-ish 2P cases that there have been in the recent past. What, of course, is in many of our minds as we reach the, or get past the middle of May, is what will happen after the 23rd of next month. Obviously, either we will remain in the EU, at any rate for the time being, or at some point we will leave, or at any rate give 2 years' notice of leaving under Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. If we stay, obviously we will continue to be bound by EU directives for rather longer, indeed indefinitely. There's no reason to suppose, so far as I'm aware, that there will be any imminent changes in the EU on the transfer of undertakings, so we will continue to have 2P. We likely may, but possibly may not, continue to have it with SPC, service provision change, added. If, on the other hand, we leave the EU, or rather start the lengthy process towards leaving the EU, then 2P, as of course a mere statutory instrument, deprived of its legislative base in the European Communities Act of 1972, goes, albeit that under the Interpretation Act, accrued rights and obligations accrued whilst 2P was in force would remain. Otherwise, no 2P, unless and until, in whole or in part, it was reenacted on who knows what timetable. One interesting question, so long as we still have 2P, may be, if we're no longer in the EU, how much attention do we pay in interpreting 2P to decisions of the European Court of Justice on the underlying directive, decisions by which, of course, at the moment, and for at least some months yet, we are bound. So, while the European Court of Justice remains supreme, I start with a European justice case from Portugal. There we are, we've got a bit beyond that, I think. There we go. As you can see, Ferreira da Silva and the Portuguese state. It's not actually a wildly important case. Indeed, one wonders how it got as far as Luxembourg. One often wonders that, of course. It is, however, on an aspect of 2P law that continues to give rise to a number of cases, to some of which I will come, on the question of the basic, fundamental, initial question of when is there a relevant transfer? That is, of course, a relevant transfer in the classic sense, whether or not there would, in the UK, be a relevant transfer by way of a service provision change. Basically, and you'll see this in my paper at the beginnings of your bundles, the European Court restates, and I won't do so now, the by now very well settled test with which we are all only too well familiar as to whether or not there is a relevant transfer. That's a paragraph 3 of my paper. There's nothing new in the formulation, it's a scissors and paste job. But the application of the test in the Portuguese case is of some interest. There was found to be a transfer because tangible assets went over. That was the key factor. And there was an economic entity which did keep its identity. The interest is the particular context in which this occurred, namely a parent company carrying out activities previously carried out by a former subsidiary. The court emphasizes that in this context, what is relevant for the purpose of finding that the identity of the transferred entity has been preserved is not the retention of the specific organisation imposed by the undertaking on various elements of production which are transferred, it is rather the retention of the fundamental link of interdependence and complementarity between those elements. I should perhaps, before that sentence, have indicated where I was beginning the quote and where I was ending it, because otherwise you'll have thought it's me who talked gobbledygook, when of course it's the ECJ. Such a functional link allows the transferee to use the various elements to pursue an analogous economic activity, even if the elements are integrated into a new and different organisational structure. So one can have pretty big differences in that respect and still have a relevant transfer, even in the classical sense. Back from Luxembourg to London, from the European Court to the EAT, and another case on whether or not there is a relevant transfer, but this time one that goes the other way, no transfer. That's Hyde Housing Association and Leighton, and a successful appeal by the employer. Question: can there be a relevant transfer from a single transferor to multiple transferees? Answer: yes, a proposition, not an issue. Further question, supplementary question: can there be a relevant transfer to multiple transferees, one of whom is the transferor? That was the issue in the case, and the answer given was no. That's the decision of the EAT in Hyde Housing Association and Leighton. Mr. Leighton was employed by Market Homes. Martlett joined the Hyde Group. The Hyde Group was restructured. This, of course, is a not unfamiliar situation in the housing association world at the present time. His employer became all the companies in the Hyde Group, including Martlett, on a joint and several basis. There was, ruled the EAT, not a sufficient change in the identity of the employer for there to be a transfer, in the language both of TUPE and of the directive, to another person. Martlett continued to remain liable as Mr. Leighton's employer on both a literal and a purposive transaction. Back from London to Luxembourg, ADIF, a European Court of Justice case, this time from the other part of the Iberian Peninsula, Spain. It concerned a situation, again one with which we're all very familiar in practice in the UK, the situation when work is taken back in-house. There's no SBC provision in Spanish law any more than there is in Portuguese. So again, this was a classic transfer or no transfer at all. The reference from the Spanish court asked whether there's a transfer of an undertaking where a public sector undertaking contracts out a service central to its activities, but then decides not to extend the contract and to assume direct responsibility for the performance using its own staff rather than the staff employed by the contractor. So the situation is that the service continues to be provided without any change other than the rather important one arising as a result of the replacement of the workers performing the activities and the fact that they're employed by a different employer. The Court of Justice was faced with a line of cases in which it was held that in a sector where the activity is based essentially on manpower, the identity of an economic entity cannot be retained if the majority of the employees are not taken on by the alleged transferee. One might have thought that would lead to a particular conclusion, but the European Court got round that line of cases in this particular case by finding that the economic activity was not based essentially on manpower because it required significant amounts of equipment. On that basis, it held that the fact that ADIF did not take over the contractor's employees did not preclude there being an economic entity which retained its identity and therefore there being a transfer. Okay, so there's a relevant transfer. What then is the time of the transfer? The EAT decision in... I'll leave that one for one moment, then move on. The EAT decision in Services for Education and White suggests that the requirement that the employee be employed immediately before the transfer should not be applied too strictly. In Salmon v. Castlebeck Care, the claimant was dismissed for alleged gross misconduct. Then there was a 2P transfer. After that, her contractual appeal succeeded. This meant that the dismissal did not take effect and her contract of employment revived. That being so, her employment was transferred. She was deemed to have been employed immediately before the transfer in that factual scenario. This was so even though she was not even told about the outcome of the appeal, still less reinstated, but the lack of communication was found to be immaterial. The lack of decision to reinstate was found to be immaterial. This was on the basis that the contract revived and revived retrospectively, in effect, automatically. Back to whether there is a relevant transfer, but now to whether there is an SPC, service provision change, transfer. In Otomo Property Services and Duncan in the AT, the issue was whether there was a relevant transfer by way of an SPC. The sub-issue was, as it has been in a number of cases since SPCs were introduced, whether the client remained the same. And the question was identifying the client. Mr. Duncan was employed by Otomo Property Services as a site maintenance manager for a housing estate. The estate comprised a number of separate housing blocks. Each separate block had a separate residence management company, and there were six maintenance contracts. These were transferred by Otomo to another company who engaged new contractors to carry out the maintenance work. Mr. Duncan was dismissed by Otomo on the ground of redundancy, and he claimed unfair dismissal. The EAT held, allowing appeal, that there may have been an SPC. The clients were the same before and after the putative SPC. There was no change in identity. In other words, client, in the singular, in the language of the regulations, can be clients in the plural, and the six clients, the six individual management companies, were sufficiently linked. So the case was remitted to the Employment Tribunal to address the question whether there was sufficient commonality between the six separate contracts. Okay, so we have a SPC transfer. What is the time of the transfer? In Jackolou and Nesta Prime Care Services, the claimant was employed by the first respondent, a care company, as one of a group of employees working on a local authority contract. Following a dispute with a colleague, she and two others were suspended on full pay pending disciplinary proceedings. The local authority gave an instruction to the company, as it was contractually entitled to do, to remove them from working on its contract. The company, however, objected to their removal and continued to maintain its objection until after the contract transferred to the second respondent in accordance with TUPE. It dealt with the disciplinary proceedings prior to the transfer by giving the claimant a written warning. After the transfer, the local authority withdrew its objection in respect of one employee but maintained it in respect of the claimant. The first respondent eventually agreed to accept the claimant as its employee and dismissed her as redundant. On her claim of unfair dismissal, an employment judge held as a preliminary issue that while the claimant was assigned to an organised grouping of employees working on the contract, she had been removed from that activity by virtue of the local authority request immediately before the service provision change, and that accordingly her employment did not transfer to the new provider and she remained an employee of the first respondent. On the appeal by the claimant, the EAT held, allowing the appeal, that there being no dispute that before the local authority's instruction to remove the claimant from working on its contract, the claimant had been assigned to an organised grouping of employees which became the subject of a service provision change, The sole question was whether the claimant was assigned to that grouping immediately before the transfer that assigned, and that meant assigned by or with the authority of the employer and not by the unilateral act of a third party without the employer's authority. The employer had protested the local authority's instruction and done nothing to remove the claimant from her assignment, and suspending the employee on full pay pending disciplinary proceedings did not have the effect of removing her from the organised grouping of employees to which she belonged. Accordingly, the only conclusion was that the claimant remained assigned to the grouping of employees which transferred to the second respondent. If there is an organised grouping that is being transferred, the question is whether at the time of the transfer the particular employee is assigned to that organised grouping, as we know. That was the question before the EAT and BT Managed Services, the Edwards. Where have we got to? This case, yes, arose in the context of an employee on long-term sick leave. Mr. Edwards had a cardiac condition. He'd not worked since January 2008. He was in receipt of permanent health insurance benefits. This was on the basis that he was permanently unable to work because of his ill health. The permanent benefit provided by the insurance company had run out. He was being paid the equivalent by the employer. He was treated by BT for administrative purposes as a member of an organised grouping working on a particular contract. The contract was then transferred by way of a service provision change on the 1st of June 2013, but the transferee refused to accept Mr. Edwards on grounds that he'd not been assigned to the group because of his long-term absence. Very long-term absence. The EAT upheld a finding that in these circumstances, the claimant could not be regarded as being assigned to the organised grouping. The EAT distinguishes employees who are permanently unable to work, as in Mr. Edwards' case, from temporary inability. The criterion of to which grouping the employee could be required to work if able to do so is useful, said the EAT, in cases where an employee is able to return to work at the time of the service provision change or is likely to be able to do so in the foreseeable future. That principle, however, has no residence or applicability in a case such as Mr. Edwards and BT, where the employee in question is permanently unable to return to work and can have no further involvement in the economic activity performed by the grouping and the performance of which is its purpose. This is a case which is due to go to the Court of Appeal next month. In order to fall within TUPE's definition of a service provision change, Regulation 33A provides that immediately before the service provision change, there must be, quote, an organised grouping of employees situated in Great Britain, which has as its principal purpose the carrying out of the activities concerned on behalf of the client, end of quote. That provision, of course, might need a spot of amendment if Scotland left the UK. Who belongs to an organised grouping is explored by the EAT in Innex Home Improvements v Hodgkins. Innex had a subcontract from Thomas Vale to perform building works on a particular contract. The claimants worked on that contract. Work was released by Thomas Vale in tranches, and in November and December of 2012, the claimants were laid off in accordance with the provisions of their respective contracts of employment. The expectation was that this would be temporary, as it was anticipated that there would be further work in January of 2013. In the event, however, Thomas Vale decided to give substantially the same work to a different subcontractor, so the employees concerned brought a claim under TUPE. The EAT held that a temporary absence from work does not preclude the continued existence of the organised grouping. temporary cessation of employment, including for the purposes of holidays, whether or not in school term time, sickness, or expressed to be a temporary layoff, as in that case, should not of itself deprive employees of their employment if there's a service provision change during the period of temporary cessation. Something more than a temporary layoff caused by a temporary absence of work is required to dissolve the organised grouping. So this is a purposive construction of 2P that avoids allowing its provisions to be circumvented by temporary layoffs prior to transfer. Whether a grouping of employees had retained its identity as such is a question of fact to be determined by the Employment Tribunal considering all the facts, including both the length and the reason for the temporary cessation of work. The next case went to the Court of Appeal, but with the same conclusion in Employment Tribunal, Employment Appeal Tribunal, and the Court of Appeal itself. Question, can a single employee be an organised grouping of employees for SPC purposes? Answer, yes. The employee, a commercial property manager, was solely responsible for managing full-time a specific property portfolio in the Netherlands. Nothing changed in that respect when there was a change of contractor. Therefore, there was a SPC. The employee devoted all her time to the employer's Dutch activities, and no other employee provided any significant assistance. So she was a one-person grouping. Her role was to carry out all of the activities which were necessary to provide the required services. Lord Justice Jackson sets out a staged approach. First, identify the service which the putative transferee was providing to the client. Second, list the activities which the staff of the putative transferor performed in order to provide that service to the client. Third, identify the employees or employee of the putative transfer who ordinarily carried out those activities. Fourth, consider whether the putative transferor organised those employees or that employee into a grouping for the principal purpose of carrying out the listed activity. One can always rely on Lord Justice Jackson to complicate things. In Mustafa v. Trek, the EAT holds that a temporary closure of an undertaking does not preclude the possibility of an SPC. A temporary cessation of work does not mean that a grouping of workers can no longer be said to be organised, and the organised grouping of employees does not have to have been actually working immediately before the transfer. De Vecchi v. Scandinavian Airlines is an EFTA court case from Norway. If we go for Brexit on the 23rd of June, and eventually, as presumably on that scenario one would, find out what on earth Brexit actually means, and if we do a Norway rather than, say, an Albania, then we may escape the clutches of the European Court of Justice, but be subject instead to the EFTA Court, which is unlikely to make the remotest degree of practical difference, because the same business transfers directive applies. One doesn't get away from that any more than one gets away, for example, from freedom of movement. This case arose out of a transfer of terminal and cargo handling operations from one part of the SAS group to another. The employees transferred were paid in accordance with the transferor's collective agreement until that was terminated after a few months. They were then slotted into the transferee's negotiated pay structure, even though this resulted in pay cuts of up to 11.5%, something one might notice. The employees claim that the transferees were obliged to continue to apply the higher pay rates they enjoyed while employed by the transferor. However, the EFTA court says that it's consistent with the directive if the pay of transferred employees under the collective agreement with the transferor is replaced by pay laid down by an agreement in force with the transferee after the expiry of the transferor's collective agreement. If the transferee's collective pay agreement is applied only after the expiry of the transferor's pay agreement, then the loss of the entitlement to a particular salary is, says the court, not linked to the transfer, but is linked to the expiry of the collective agreement. And therefore, the issue of whether the application of new conditions results in a pay reduction, even as here a significant pay reduction, can therefore have no influence on the assessment under the directive. According to the EFTA court, a national rule may give continued effects to a collective agreement, but the transferee must be in a position to make adjustments and changes necessary to carry out its operations. Since continued effects applicable after the expiration of a collective agreement limit the freedom of action of the transferee, such a national rule must be limited in its duration. Otherwise, it would bind the transferee indefinitely. So what one sees here is a similar approach to that that the European Court of Justice took in the Alemo Heron case, in which the court held that the directive, quote, does not aim solely to safeguard the interests of employees in the event of the transfer of an undertaking, but seeks to ensure a fair balance between the interests of those employees on the one hand and those of the transferee employer on the other hand. And the court stressed the employer's right to conduct a business. So it's not all about safeguarding employees' rights. There is a balance to be struck. There can be a service provision change when the client intends that the activities will be carried out by the transferees other than in connection with a task of short-term duration. And the EAT holds in ICTS v. Mardi that the relevant intention of the client must relate to the task to be carried out and its intended duration rather than to the activities. And the court said this, the Employment Appeal Tribunal, subsequent events can be relevant in deciding someone's intention. It would be an error of law entirely to ignore such events and to fail to make findings of fact about them if they were potentially relevant, end of quote. Seems a rather circular statement. However, the relevance of subsequent events relates only to drawing an inference from the circumstances. Such circumstances can obviously include contemporaneous expressions of intent and actions by the relevant party or its agents, but they can also include what the party says or does not say after the relevant event, in particular in response to the forensic process. And there is no reason why they cannot also include subsequent events or non-events, provided, of course, that those events are capable of casting light on the intention of the relevant party at the relevant date, and the fact, and that the fact finder bears in mind that the ultimate issue is to be decided in intention and not outcome. So a pretty broad area of inquiry in relation to a question of what somebody's intention was at a particular moment in time. NHS Direct and Gun, chaps, remember when you come on that when you press this, it doesn't always do the business unless you hold it down hard or press it again. NHS Direct v. Gun in the AT is about the interface between TUPE and the Equality Act in the case of disabled employees and the context of reasonable adjustments. Ms. Gunn is disabled with rheumatoid arthritis. She worked for Shropshire Doctors Cooperative Limited, and they provided an emergency call service for the NHS. As a reasonable adjustment, she was permitted to work only 8.5 hours per week. There then loomed a transfer of the service to NHS Direct. Ms. Gunn was told by them that all of their staff were required to work a minimum of 15 hours per week, and that this requirement would be applied to her. As a result, she objected to being transferred and remained with the transferor employer in a less congenial post. She brought a disability discrimination claim against the transferees, arguing that they had failed to make a reasonable adjustment. She succeeded. She succeeded on the basis that the transferee was making an offer of alternative employment for her to work 15 hours per week. That, of course, begs the question, what about the situation if there had been no such offer? It would seem that the AT was saying that there was no automatic transfer of a reasonable adjustment. But I ask, can that be right? We will have to wait another case in order to see.